Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Criminal justice reform is an issue that many liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, can agree on. Reform efforts are being made in Pennsylvania to shorten the length of probation and the infractions that could result in someone being sent to prison. These moves have already been made in several other states. Joining us on today's program is Jessica Jackson, Chief Advocacy Officer with the Reform Alliance. Ms. Jackson, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
And David Savavian, who is the American Conservative Union's General Counsel and Deputy Director for the Center for Criminal Justice Reform. Mr. Savavian, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. Good morning.
Morning. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Jessica Jackson, let me start with you. Why do you support, and this is a national effort, but why do you support reform being made in the criminal justice system, specifically about probation?
Yeah, well, that's an important question. I think some people are surprised when they find out that I have devoted my career to criminal justice reform. I'm a mother of two. I'm an attorney. I am a former mayor of a city. But about 15 years ago, I was none of that. In fact, I was a high school dropout with my GED. And I had a husband who was on his way to prison 2 months after we'd had our daughter. So it was because I saw what goes on in our criminal justice system up close and personal that really changed the trajectory of my life. We were absolutely devastated and financially ruined, not to mention isolated and ashamed and emotionally ruined by the experience. Specifically probation and parole. There's about 2.2 million people who are incarcerated in our country, but there's about 4.65 million who are on probation or parole or some form of community supervision and just living their lives sitting on the edge of their seats, wondering if today is going to be the day that they end up going back to jail or prison, not even for committing a new crime. So it's extremely expensive. It's immoral. And it's causing, you know, families and communities a lot of heartache across the country.
Mr. Savavian, I'll ask you the same question. Why do you support these reform efforts being made?
So I get that question a lot, and especially coming from the American Conservative Union, right? We're the nation's largest and oldest grassroots advocacy organization. We were founded by Bill Buckley in 1964. Why are we in criminal justice reform? We're really in it for three reasons. The first is public safety. And the real question is, are we as Americans, you all as Pennsylvanians, getting the most public safety for your buck? Because we spend an enormous amount of money on criminal justice system in our prisons in particular. And, you know, our goal is to make sure that we're getting what we pay for. And the second reason is we really do believe in government accountability. The government should be using our money wisely. What we often don't see is a correlation between very costly criminal justice programs and a return in public safety. And that's particularly what we have with Pennsylvania's current probation system. And the third really is human dignity. You know, we at ACU believe we're all created in God's image, and we can all find redemption at a certain level. And, you know, that permanent scarlet F of being a convicted felon can haunt people, keep them out of the workforce. It hurts our economy. It hurts our neighborhoods and communities. All those reasons are why we're into criminal justice reform. Mm-hmm. Why are we in... Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You finish.
I was just going to say, why are we in the fight about probation in Pennsylvania? Because right now, about half the people, actually slightly more than half the people, going as new admissions into Pennsylvania's prison system are for technical violations, things like running late, missing an appointment, going outside the state, having a dirty urine test. And the result of that is it's costing Pennsylvanians $335 million a year in unnecessary corrections costs. And that is diverting huge amounts of resources from really more effective public safety operations like violent crimes task forces, human trafficking investigations. State troopers, as much as I own a little piece of blacktop on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, courtesy of your state troopers, they play such an important role, and we can't fund them. So that's why we are involved in the probation fight right now, and it couldn't be more important.
Well, okay, let me follow up on that, Mr. Savavian, what you just said. You said about conservatives, and often people think of people who are politically conservative as the law and order types, that what used to be the thought does, lock them up, throw away the key, and that's how you kept the public safe. What changed?
So, I think that is a fair assessment of where we were. I don't think that that is an assessment of where we are, and I can give you a couple of data points, and then I'll explain what happened. The first is, in just a year and a half ago, the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, every year. It's a big deal. President comes, a lot of government comes, a lot of opinion leaders. And we asked our 15,000 activists in 17 whether or not we should be involved in criminal justice reform, and we got an astronomical number of people that said yes. It was 60% saying yes and an additional percentage saying overwhelmingly yes. And it wasn't just kind of a soft, squishy push-pull type of question. We then asked them, well, what are the important things we should be engaged in? And the first was drug dependency, and the second was mandatory minimums, and the third was asset forfeiture. The reason why I think we're seeing a change in how conservatives view criminal justice is data. We are flooded with data, and we can now look at what works and what doesn't, right? And the best example I can give you is Texas. In 2005, then-Governor Rick Perry was told he was going to have to build four new prisons. And Perry said, no, I'm not going to do that. Let's find another way out. And what he put knocked heads together, he got Democrats and Republicans in a room, and they came up with something called justice reinvestment. And I don't want to go down a rabbit hole too far, but let me just give you 30 seconds on it. Justice reinvestment was a real simple concept, that we lock up the people we're afraid of, not necessarily the people we're mad at, meaning take the public safety threats off the street, reduce the number of prison beds, which are really expensive, and then use a portion of that cost savings to help those criminals that really were public safety threats to emerge from prison no longer as public safety threats. Because remember, about 97% of people in prison will be in our neighborhoods eventually. Okay, so we did that in 2007. What do we have as a result? They didn't build four prisons that they thought they had to. They closed eight more. They've cut recidivism because they're providing things like anger management treatment, job training, cognitive behavioral therapy to the violent offenders. They've saved and return to the taxpayers $3 billion in the state of Texas. Now, most conservatives will say, I'm willing to fund more of this if it makes my neighborhood safer and it protects my family. Well, guess what? In Texas, 12 years later, they have the lowest crime rate since they had in 1967. So we've cut incarceration, we've cut taxpayer costs, and we've made Texas safer. That's the type of data that's unassailable.
Jessica Jackson, same reasons? Do you support for the same reasons as when you're talking about liberal, progressive, and conservatives?
Yeah, I think, we share a lot of the public safety concerns. We know that disrupting people's lives and putting them back in jail or prison for technical violation, that's actually going to make public safety worse, not just the individual's circumstances worse and their family's circumstances worse, but it's going to create some more public safety issues. For example, let's say you've got somebody who has come home from prison, they've found a job, they're doing well, they've got custody of their kids back, their kids are in, a local school, they've got housing, which is a huge hurdle for people coming home from prison, they've got transportation, they've bought a car, they're making payments, and then they have a slip-up. Maybe they can't make a restitution payment because they've popped a tire on their way to work and they need to pay for that instead, or they miss a meeting with their probation officer, or maybe they even come back with a bad urine test. Suddenly they're picked up and put back into incarceration. By the time they get out, they've lost their home or their housing situation. They may have fallen far behind on their vehicle payments. They've probably lost their job because not many people can miss more than a couple of days of work let alone sometimes months that people are sitting in there waiting on a hearing to establish whether or not there even was a violation. You know, so it can have extreme impacts on people. We're paying so much money into a system to, you know, supervise so many different people. That money could be much better spent preventing crime in the first place. When you look at what actually drives crime and how to actually address and prevent crime, you know, we're looking at mental health treatment. We're looking at addiction treatment. We're looking at economic programs that help people get back on their feet through job training and job placement. We don't have the money currently to fund those programs that actually work and get people from being a tax burden to being a taxpayer, because we're spending all of our money supervising and incarcerating people, many times just for technical violations.
All right, let me, there are a couple of things that I want to address, ask a question about, but technical violations, the scenarios you just listed, flat tire, being late for an appointment, okay, we could call them technical violations, but aren't they still violations?
They're violations, but again, I can't say that they serve any sort of public safety risk, right? The fact that I fall behind on a restitution payment, yes, that's not a good fact, but it doesn't mean that I am a risk to public safety. So there's no need to incarcerate me. In fact, I become more of a risk once I've lost my job and my housing situation and all of that. So I think, you know, even though they are some form of a violation, we've got a system that's set up to just punish people, punish people, punish people, even for the smallest things. And we have no incentive to give people who are actually complying with probation or even going above and beyond that, reducing the chance that they'll end up back in jail or prison, maybe going to school, maybe doing community service, maybe getting their technical vocational degree or seeking treatment for an addiction. There's no incentive for people to do those or to comply with probation. And instead, we've got all sticks and we're just locking people up.
Mr. Safavian, let me ask you the same question, though, about the technical violations. Would the legislation, has the legislation in other states done away with these rules for if you're late talking to your probation officer or something like that?
Look, this is an easy one, right? First of all, let's talk about what we're really, or let's identify what we're talking about, and that is these technical violations are actions that wouldn't be illegal but for the fact that they're on probation. Now, I get that, you know, rules are rules and everybody should live by them, but this is a category of people that, you know, if they showed up late for an appointment, they wouldn't be thrown in jail but for the fact that they're on probation. But that's not even the main issue here, right? The main issue is that every bit of data shows that the most effective way to correct that behavior is swift, immediate, and swift, certain, and proportional sanctions, right? The difference we're talking about here is, do you throw them back in jail for the remainder of their sentence? I mean, prison actually is the right term. Do we completely throw everything out and send them right back to finish their sentence? Or do we ding them a bit, but not throw them all the way back in? Here's the analogy. If a child touches a hot stove, you don't ground them for 3 years, right? You explain to them what they did wrong, you hold them accountable, but yet you don't take the ultimate punishment. It doesn't make sense from a public safety perspective. It costs an enormous amount of money, and it's not teaching anybody new lessons, right? So the approach we're trying to take in Pennsylvania is the approach we've taken in 22 other states, which is, yes, sanction them, but it doesn't mean that you completely revoke their probation. It means maybe a weekend in jail. It means maybe restrictions on what you can do during the day or at night. There are an unlimited number of ways that you can slap somebody on the wrist for showing up late to an appointment without saying, okay, you're going to go back and do 5 years.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Check out some of the upcoming topics for Smart Talk at WITF.org/smarttalk. Some of the shows we're working on over the next couple weeks. A new Franklin and Marshall poll is out later this week, where we find out what Pennsylvanians think of President Trump's performance, Governor Wolf's performance, a lot of other issues. Also, a new book about James Buchanan, and NPR's Noel King will be with us coming up in a few weeks as well. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today we're talking about criminal justice reform, specifically about probation reform. As one of our guests mentioned just a few minutes ago, over 20 states have enacted legislation doing what the Pennsylvania legislature is looking at right now. David Savavian is the American Conservative Union's General Counsel and Deputy Director for the Center for Criminal Justice Reform, and Jessica Jackson, Chief Advocacy Officer with the Reform Alliance. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Jessica Jackson, something you said a little while ago about using the money that is spent on sending people to jail in other ways, programs that actually prevent crime. You know, let's face it, whether it's a state government, the federal government, even on the local level, dollars are tight. Very often, when you have people lobbying for programs that, I think of one in particular, pre-K, early childhood education, that there has been data to show and research to show that children who have gone through those programs are less likely when they become adults to be criminal offenders. One of the issues that we do run into, though, is people thinking long term, that those dollars that are so tight are spent for today rather than what's coming down the road. Is this an issue? Can you get people to think about the savings in criminal justice reform, to think about, okay, here's a way that these dollars can be better spent?
This is an area I really appreciate. I served 6 years on the Mill Valley, California City Council and served as mayor for one of those years. And every single year in May, we had to sit down and look at the budget. We were a small town, about 14,000 people, and we had a $32 million budget a year, that 75% of which went to our salaries and pensions. So we were pretty constrained and often found ourselves, you know, just having to take a Band-Aid approach and put the funding where we absolutely needed it immediately. So I really appreciate the situation that lawmakers are in, with limited resources, immediate needs, and little time for long-term planning. But this is one of those situations that has been going on for decades and decades and decades. And we are not seeing anything positive, public safety-wise, come out of investing in incarceration over investing in community programs that will actually address the underlying reasons why people are committing crime and prevent crime in the first place. So I hear your question, and I think, yes, absolutely. People have to be thinking about the long term, and people really are starting to. As David mentioned earlier, you know, Texas is a model for that. At some point, Governor Rick Perry got fed up throwing so much money into incarceration and said, wait, let's figure out a way not to build new prisons. Let's figure out a way to actually restructure the system. They've still got a lot of work to do. Many states have started to make that transition and started to think about how they can use money to actually make communities safer instead of just these stupid lock 'em up policies.
So what would you advocate? How would you spend that money that it does have a long-term effect on public safety?
Well, I think one thing that we see in the criminal justice system, and I say this as somebody who's practiced criminal defense and met with a lot of people who have been accused of committing criminal acts, one thing we see often is that people who commit crimes have often been victims themselves. So I think we need to be putting a lot more money into victim services, into making sure people are getting the help they need when a crime is committed and they are a crime survivor and are trying to cope with and find a way to heal from that crime and get back on their feet. I think we also need to be putting more resources into, as I said before, addiction and mental health treatment. We've got extremely high rates of mental health issues inside of our prisons and jails. And you know what? Prisons and jails weren't really built to deal with mental health issues, right? It's not fair that when a police officer shows up at somebody's house or shows up at an incident, they are possibly looking at an incident driven by addiction and having to deal with substance abuse. They're possibly looking at an incident driven by mental health, having to deal with mental health issues of the individual, possibly some economic issues, and they've only got one tool in their belt, and that's a pair of handcuffs. So we're just driving, you know, all of these people who their crimes are stemming from these other underlying factors into our prisons and jails in a one-size-fits-all or one-size-fails-all sort of solution, and it's just not working.
Mr. Savagian, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think I'm reticent to go down the road of using savings from criminal justice reforms for economic types of challenges. But where I really do agree with Jessica 100% is that our jails and prisons have become substitutes for mental health care facilities. And if you talk to any sheriff out there, and they will say their number one challenge is mental health because people, you know, do stupid things. People do crazy things, literally. And at the end of the day, the only place that they can go, the only place they are sent to are jails. And it's enormously costly. It is completely ineffective. People come out of jail. If you're going in with a mental hygiene issue, you are going to come out worse, and you're going to reoffend, and then you're going to get tagged with a reoffender, and then set a reoffender's sentence, and next thing you know, you're doing a three strikes type of thing. It is arguably the number one challenge for particularly large city jails and sheriffs across the country. And if we can't figure out what's the right way of dealing with mental health, it's only going to get worse, and it's going to consume a huge amount of budget, and it's going to consume a huge amount of human capital.
The two of you agree on a lot of issues, and one we point out often that when we're talking about this issue, it is an issue that conservatives and progressive liberals can agree on, Democrats, Republicans. 22 states have come up with this legislation, have passed this legislation. We don't know whether it's going to happen here in Pennsylvania, even though there is bipartisan support. So if there's agreement on both sides of the political aisle, what's holding it up, maybe even nationally across all 50 states? Jessica Jackson, what do you think?
I would say, you know, last year we saw a huge breakthrough nationally. We saw President Trump, a president who I don't think anybody expected to be super strong on criminal justice reform, signed the First Step Act, federal legislation that was both sentencing and prison reform, aimed to make our prisons more rehabilitative and get people job ready for when they were coming home. That effort was led by a bipartisan group. David was a part of it. I was a part of it. Justice Action Network and many other groups, Freedom Works, they were all a part of it in making that happen. And it was a huge bipartisan effort that I think was seen trickle down into the states. We've seen a bunch of bills similar to the First Step Act passed across the states this year. And I know there's more legislation coming next year. So I think you've just started to see the fruits of both sides coming together in the legislation that's being passed over the last couple of years. Now, you're right, David and I agree on a lot of the issues within criminal justice reform. Of course, there are a lot of issues out there that David and I don't agree on, but we've been able to put the politics aside and put people first and really start addressing where we can find common ground in criminal justice.
David, why do you think that this hasn't been universal?
So, let me, you know, Jessica touched on it, and that is when President Trump jumped in and pursued the First Step Act, it was aside from the substance, it was a massive signal to Republicans across the country that it's okay to get involved in justice reform and not worry about a challenge from the right. And you know, he's basically saying, come on in, the water's warm, it's okay. It's also why we saw, and we continue to see, a few of these folks who are from the lock them up and throw away the key side of things, fight kicking and screaming, because they knew that if they could kill the First Step Act last year, justice reforms would be dead across the water. The fact that we passed the First Step Act with an overwhelming number of, we had 89 members of the Senate, 88, one was on travel, an overwhelming bipartisan majority in the Senate and the House, means that criminal justice reform will continue and grow. Let me flag one thing. That is, you know, there is this group of conservatives that see a shiny badge and salute, and that's probably the right thing to do, except that as conservatives, we're always skeptical of big government. There is no reason why we shouldn't challenge big government in the field of criminal justice, just like we do in welfare and transportation and appropriations. And that's what we advocate all the time. Scott, let me just throw one pitch in for you all, because we're doing something in Pennsylvania that I think is important to your listeners. We're doing our first ever CPAC in a prison, and that prison is in Chester, Pennsylvania. So we will have policymakers from Washington, D.C. coming in, opinion leaders, experts talking about some of the drivers of the criminal justice reforms that we're pursuing. We're being welcomed in by Pennsylvania Secretary of Corrections Wetzel. Day one is inside Chester Prison. Day two, though, is open to the public. It's at the American Revolutionary War Museum, and you can find tickets on our website at conservative.org.
Mm-hmm. Over the summer, as you probably are aware here in Pennsylvania, over the summer, six murders occurred that allegedly were committed by parolees. Now, that's different than probation, but it still is apparently holding up the passage of these bills here in Pennsylvania. That, you know, people look at this and they're obviously concerned about it when, especially that short of amount of time and six brutal murders that have allegedly been committed by those who are on parole. How do you respond to that when people say, well, wait a minute, maybe we're going a little too fast on this? Jessica, what do you say to that?
Yeah, and, you know, I read about those murders, and obviously my heart went out to the victims and to their families. They were absolutely devastating and brutal, as you said. You know, I do have to say that it is unfortunate that for all the success stories that we have out there, for all the people who come home from prisons and jails, that we don't hear about those stories. I've seen this firsthand as people have been coming home from the First Step Act, and they've been coming back to their families. They've been ending up, you know, getting jobs and becoming members of their community, contributing to their community. It's very hard to get those kind of stories out into the media. I think what we see is that the media has really sensationalized a lot of the crime that's happened. And over the last few decades, built this narrative and this stigma around people who have been incarcerated that's really, really hard to break through. The one thing we've been doing is working very, very closely with people who have been incarcerated, brilliant people who have come home and said that they want to help change that narrative. They've come up to Harrisburg. They've talked about their stories. One group, Families Against Mandatory Minimums, brought over 100 people up to Harrisburg just a few weeks ago for a lobby day, and they were the most powerful advocates, more powerful than any attorney or policymaker in the room. They were the most powerful advocates for why we need change, why we need to give people a chance. So like you said, probation is a totally different animal than parole, but it really needs to be reformed, and unfortunately we don't hear a lot about the success stories of people coming home because the media is just not interested in covering those.
Well, okay, but let's face it, when you have six people dead, that's and committed by parolees, that's a news story. I don't know how, if you can sensationalize that or not, but I know where you're coming from.
Yeah, but here, I think you guys are both missing the point here, right? When we're spending $335 million to unnecessarily lock up technical violators in Pennsylvania's prisons, those are resources that can be used to target people who are dangerous. Why do you have a parole officer or a probation, I'm sorry, a probation officer who's overloaded with a case file of probably 80 to 90 people, he can't supervise every single one, right? While we're at the same time, we're wasting a third of $1 billion to lock up people who are late for an appointment. That's the issue. That's why this is a public safety issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not like the federal government where you can write checks that are rubber and bounce all day long. Pennsylvania has to live within its means, which means tough decisions. And if you're going to waste money locking up people unnecessarily on probation, those are resources that you are depriving of parole officers to make sure that, and the criminal justice system as a whole, with things like risk assessment tools, you're depriving the system as a whole of the tools and the resources necessary to make sure that the people who are violent don't go out and commit more murders. Six murders are an indictment of the status quo.
Let me read a couple emails we have from listeners. A caller called to say that that is someone who has been on probation. He feels that the system works well for individuals who are proactive about their probation and make an effort. It sounds as if he's criticizing those that somehow they do have a technical violation. Sarah from Carlisle called to say, using the example of mental health issues is real. Cuts in mental health funding is a big part of the problem. So that goes with what you were saying, both of you were saying earlier. We're almost out of time for this portion of the show. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. So obviously you're not just focusing on Pennsylvania. This is a national effort. But what happens next? I mean, when you have both sides of the political aisle saying that this is something that would benefit society, benefit the people who could be incarcerated, not break up families. So what happens next?
Well, at this point, we're hoping that our lawmakers choose to vote yes for SB 14 and HB 1555 next, and that we get the bill over to the governor's desk and that he'll choose to sign it. So in my mind, those are the next steps.
David?
So we're working on probation reform in Pennsylvania. We're working on reforms to ensure that incarcerated women are provided a measure of dignity in Pennsylvania. Things like, are you shackled when you're going into labor? Are you provided, if you can't afford them yourself, are you provided with feminine hygiene products when you're in prison or in jail? That's another bill we're working on in Pennsylvania. But we're active in 20 states right now. We're also active at the federal level working on things like ban the box, on things like, we're trying to put together a mental health bill. The Next Step Act after the First Step Act we're trying to develop. We're very active on so many different issues in criminal justice and otherwise across the country. And the work never stops.
Jessica Jackson is Chief Advocacy Officer with the Reform Alliance. David Savavian is the American Conservative Union's General Counsel and Deputy Director for the Center for Criminal Justice Reform. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Listen tomorrow for Smart Talk, and our topic will be, our first topic anyway, will be lawmakers using campaign cash for many purposes. Is the spending campaign related? Pennsylvania has weak laws that don't require them to provide a lot of information, and this has been a year-long investigation by Spotlight PA and the Caucus, and just a wonderful series last week about campaign spending. We'll have two of the reporters on tomorrow's show. You can also visit our website to get an outlook of conversations we're working on. Go to WITF.org/smarttalk. When President Trump took office, renegotiating U.S. trade deals was one of his priorities. Trade negotiators revised the 25-year-old NAFTA agreement in 2018. It is now officially known as the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. Mexico ratified the terms last summer. Canada is reportedly ready to sign the deal, but is waiting on U.S. congressional approval. So why is it taking so long for Congress to act? Joining us is Linda Dempsey, Vice President of International Affairs Policy for the National Association of Manufacturers. Ms. Dempsey, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Morning. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Linda Dempsey, you want to see this agreement approved and implemented. Why? What's in it for manufacturers?
This is a super important deal for manufacturers across the country and certainly in the state of Pennsylvania. These two countries are our largest purchasers of manufactured goods today, and we believe that these new provisions in this deal are going to help us be able to increase manufactured goods exports, increase our partnerships, and really help U.S. manufacturing be more competitive with all the other global competitive actors with which we face.
You know, often this has been portrayed as not much different than NAFTA. What is in the new USMCA agreement that benefits manufacturers in America and and in Pennsylvania?
So there are actually a lot of really important changes and updates in this agreement. I would always start for the modern manufacturing sector with intellectual property protection, protecting our innovations, our trade secrets, our patents, the things that help manufacturers in the United States be more competitive in global markets. And so this includes updated, important rules that helps the full breadth of manufacturers protect that innovation, setting stronger rules not just for North America, but hopefully for the rest of the world as well. So that's one. The second is, you know, manufacturers today, whether it's in their shop floor, in the products that they're producing, the cars we drive, the tractors we drive, are all digitally connected. And so there was nothing in the original NAFTA that dealt with digital rules. It was 25 years ago. We didn't have the internet that we have today or all the changes and modernizations we've seen. Important new rules to make sure that digital economy works. But there's more. There's new rules to ensure fair competition when we're dealing with foreign state-owned enterprises in Mexico and Canada as well. New rules, updated rules that address the myriad of unfair trade barriers that foreign countries put on our products that limit our ability to sell into those markets, whether it's technical barriers or other barriers that affect our food and farm exports. There's really important new progress on all of those rules in this agreement, as well as new rules to streamline customs, border red tape, so we can move more goods back and forth between our three countries in a way that's more seamless, reducing costs for manufacturers here so we can be more competitive there.
So what do you think's holding up in the agreement?
So one of the areas I didn't talk about, there's really new updated rules on labor and environment in the agreement, and we can talk about that. But that's where particularly the Democrats on Capitol Hill want to see if there aren't some more provisions, more enforcement of those provisions to include in the agreement. And so over the summer, Speaker Pelosi set up a working group that's working with the U.S. Trade Representative right now to try to see what other updates that they can make to try to move this agreement forward.
But when you're talking about those updates, I said earlier in the introduction, Mexico has already signed off on this. Canada says that they're probably going to sign off very quickly after the Congress approves it here in the United States. But those changes the Democrats have asked for, and by the way, labor for the most part supports those changes that Democrats are asking for. Environmentalists support those changes. But those changes could mean going back and changing the text of the agreement, and that could mean going back to Mexico and Canada, couldn't it?
It absolutely could, and there are discussions that our negotiators here in the United States are having with their counterparts in Mexico and Canada on all of these issues. It's the million-dollar question how some of this gets put into the final agreement and how that's done. I'm a trade lawyer by training, and you know there's a lot of different ways that this could be done. I think at the end of the day, all sides appear to be moving forward in a lot of good faith. We hear a lot from the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, a Democrat, Mr. Neal, last week saying, you know, we're making progress, we're taking issues off the table, we're narrowing the differences, we're hearing the same from the administration. And so, look, I think, you know, we're pressing both sides to move this forward as quickly as possible. There's been a lot of uncertainty for the manufacturing sector. We've seen some weaker numbers lately. And moving forward, this deal would really be a shot in the arm to help boost our manufacturers and increase our ability to sell there and improve our competitiveness.
There are those that believe Democrats don't want to give the president a political victory with the passage of this agreement. Speaker Pelosi has not said that. In fact, she has said we want to get this passed as much as possible. But is there always is some politics, but is that part of the reason that this is being held up?
Look, I think we have heard all year from Speaker Pelosi and Democrats in the House and the Senate, and we do, you know, hundreds of meetings with these folks as well as the Republican counterparts. What we hear every day is that Democrats do want to find a way to get to yes. Now, that doesn't mean that every Democrat's going to vote for this agreement at the end of the day, but that they recognize that already in this agreement, there's a lot of really good, positive things. You know, I mentioned earlier on the labor and environment piece, the original NAFTA, you might remember, right, it was an afterthought to include labor and environment side agreements that President Bill Clinton negotiated soon after he came into office. And those were relatively weak agreements. Countries need to enforce their own law. There's no real strong enforcement measure. Fast forward to the USMCA, this agreement already includes modern labor environment provisions. Mexico, Canada, but really Mexico on the labor side, has to implement in its domestic law new labor provisions much more similar to what we have here in the United States, similarly on environment, and there's strict enforcement on that. And indeed, when Mexico approved the agreement, it also approved a sweeping, massive reform of its labor law that I think a lot of folks, particularly on the Democratic side, have been looking for decades. So we've seen some progress. The two sides are trying to get more progress. We think this can get done. We're just hoping it moves forward as quickly as possible. We'd love to see a vote before Thanksgiving, but certainly by the end of the year.
And we'll talk about that time issue in just a moment, but what you were referring to, labor rights in Mexico, part of that is there's more protection for unions in Mexico and also an increased minimum wage. Looking at this from strictly an American manufacturing point of view, will that benefit American workers, American manufacturers, and limit offshore American jobs?
So we, you know, I absolutely yes. So these new provisions on labor in particular are really helping to raise standards, will help to raise standards, already have helped raise standards in Mexico in ways that create what we call as a more level playing field. And that's going to help our manufacturers. Now, look, a lot of manufacturers have partnerships in Mexico and Canada that make us more competitive. You know, the biggest issue the manufacturing sector in the United States has right now is needing to find skilled workers. We have about 500,000 open jobs in manufacturing, really good paying jobs that were hard to fill. And so the partnerships we actually have with Canada and Mexico help us be more competitive in all of that. But by raising these standards going forward, we're going to see better levels of production, better partnerships. We're going to grow more of those higher value, higher wage manufacturing jobs we absolutely want to do here in the United States.
If you're just tuning in, our guest is Linda Dempsey, Vice President of International Affairs Policy for the National Association of Manufacturers. We're talking about the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement and why the Congress, what the Congress has to do to get it approved. We have about 5 minutes left in the program. If you would like to ask a question, 1-800-729-7532. On Twitter, we're at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Ms. Dempsey, you referred to the time limits and you said that you'd really like to get this done by Thanksgiving. Quite frankly, you know, it's probably hard for a lot of people to believe, but there are only a few weeks left in 2019 and even less on the calendar for the Congress being in session. So how much of an issue is time, especially when you consider that next year is an election year when the Congress is not as quick to pick up on some meaningful legislation, put it that way?
Time is really critical from our point of view. You are exactly right. There are very few days left when Congress is in session and can take up and move this type of legislation. We certainly believe that where there's a will, there is a way to move this forward. There have been a lot of hearings already. There's been a lot of discussions in both the House and Senate. But really, at some point, we've got to see that final deal and are hoping the two sides can continue to move quickly. We've seen a real big uptick in the discussions between the administration and this House Democratic Working Group in the last 2 weeks alone, and I think that signals really positive things. But we all know with the negotiation, it's those last issues that are the hardest, and so we're continuing to go up and talk to members in the House and Senate, urging them to get this deal done and figure out a way to bring it to the House and Senate floor this year.
Getting the trade agreement approved by the Congress is one thing. From what I understand, though, the White House hasn't sent implementing legislation to the Congress. So even if the deal is approved right now, there's not legislation to implement it, you know, to make the deal actually become law. So, I mean, is that just a technicality? I mean, does that happen afterwards, or is that a bit of a hurdle?
So the administration has held off sending the implementing legislation for final approval of the USMCA because of these negotiations going on with the House Democratic Working Group and the U.S. Trade Representative's office. And so that's the right move from their perspective, because there might be things in that implementing legislation that are agreed to by this House Working Group, so they don't want to put the cart before the horse. The process, as we see it, the process really has to conclude between the administration and the House Democrats. And once that's done, there'll be some conversations with Mexico and Canada, like we were discussing before. And then the administration can move forward on that implementing legislation. So that's the process as we see it. And again, we're still pressing everybody to see if we can get this done by Thanksgiving.
There has been a trade war with China and, to a lesser degree, the European Union. Will the USMCA make a difference?
It absolutely is critical for us to be able to move this agreement on a bipartisan basis, to be able to show the rest of the world that the United States can lead on issues of international trade. If we can't do USMCA, think about what type of message that says to our friends in the European Union or to China, where we're trying to negotiate with them right now. If we can't get Congress and the administration on the same page on a pro-growth, pro-manufacturing type of agreement like the USMCA, I think our trading partners might doubt our ability to do anything else that's even harder. This relationship is so important for manufacturers, right? We've got millions of workers across the country who depend on this relationship. You know, one out of four Pennsylvania manufacturers depend on trade with Canada and Mexico right now. And most of those are small and medium-sized businesses, right, who are exporting to these countries, who are partnering with these countries. So this is a big deal. And we should and really have to get this agreement done.
We have less than 60 seconds left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Quick answer to this, if you can. Have manufacturers, what impact has the tariffs had on manufacturers?
Manufacturers have been facing a number of headwinds in the global economy. We talked about workforce, but some of these trade tensions and tariffs are certainly, creating uncertainty for manufacturers. They impact different manufacturers in different ways, depending on what the tariffs are. But certainly that whole level of uncertainty is one of the challenges that we're facing right now.
If you had to make a prediction, will we hear something concrete about USMCA in the next few weeks?
I absolutely hope that we will, yes.
Linda Dempsey, Vice President of International Affairs Policy for the National Association of Manufacturers. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about how campaign contributions are being spent by those elected to office here in Pennsylvania. So be sure to tune in.